Everybody, thanks for joining us. We're going to get started. Today is general questions, anything goes. I'll let you know right now, calls are starting to come in, but they're still a little light. Mondays are usually quiet. So we're going to do either 1 or 2 hours, depending on how many questions we have. If you have a question, a comment, a topic, right now is a great opportunity to get through. Press 1 on your phone. I guarantee we'll get to you. Some days the calls start to pile up pretty quick. So the sooner you get in and press 1, the better your chances, and I'll keep you updated on how we're doing. Let's get started.
Money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right to some phone calls today and see what it is you want to talk about. I've got some things I might jump in with later, but for now, we're going to see what it is you want to talk about. This is the show where we take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority, you name it. We'll talk about it. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. And we're going to start off in Ohio today. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Kevin, thanks for taking my call. Kevin, the reason I'm calling is I had a friend that was listening to your show about, you was talking about air-to-airs, and there was a company that made them a little bit better than the factory. They had rubber garments in where the tubes go into the tanks. You know what I'm talking about or not?
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I called them, and they told me that they were, once they sold what they had, they're looking for a different manufacturer. It just so happened my truck, they was no longer available and was sold out, and didn't know when they would ever even find someone to start making them again. Did you know anything about that or not?
So who? I'm not sure who you called. Who did you call?
Okay, I had a friend to look it up on your website, and
okay,
they text me a number, and I called the number. To be honest with you, I don't remember.
Okay,
the factory I called.
So the company is called Duralite, and they've been around for a long, long time. Great company. They're the only ones that build a charger cooler this way with the rubber grommets. They warranty it for 1,000,000 miles. They virtually never leak. They're really by far the best charger cooler on the market. And price-wise, they're about the same. I mean, there are times, depending on the truck, where if I look at the OEM charger cooler, the Duralite's actually cheaper sometimes. Sometimes it's a little more, but it's usually just about the same price. Now, Duralite does not sell directly. So you can't really call Duralite and order a charger cooler. You have to go through a Duralite dealer. And that might be a lot of truck shops are Duralite dealers. So the answer you got doesn't make a lot of sense. Duralite is clearly still making charger coolers, lots of them, they're growing. So I'm not really sure, like I say, that answer doesn't make a lot of sense.
Kevin, could you get Lisa to text me a number that I can call someone? And I mean, maybe I had the wrong phone number, I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds a little confusing. So let me do this. I'll put you on hold and I will have Bridget get you the number for Duralight. And if for so, actually, I'm going to be meeting with somebody from Duralight tomorrow. They're in town, so we're going to spend some time with them. If for some reason we get you a number and you still don't get an answer, you will if we get you to Duralight, but call us back and we'll get it handled for you. Let's head off to Arizona. Leo, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, you should have an oil sample there in front of you.
I do, and I'm looking at it now. It
It's
looks
actually
like.
coming.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it fairly looks clean and all that, but I'm still kind of wondering about a few things like the iron throughout the history. If you can see, they didn't flag it at 40 or 38. They did it at 20. Why would that be?
Yeah, this is interesting and it confuses a lot of people. What happens here is there's no one number where they flag it at, level one or level two. And that can get very confusing for people. There are differences in engines when they flag it. There are differences in how many miles you've got on the oil. And that's the biggest one. So based on how many miles are on the oil itself or how many miles are on the engine, and I'm looking at yours, and it looks like you don't have a unit time on there. And in the block for unit time, what they're looking for there is how many miles are on the engine, either since new or since an in-frame. And yours is showing up at zero. So they're missing a piece of information that they need in order to rate this correctly. And then under lube time, it's showing 541,000 miles. I think that's probably the engine time. And we would need to get the lube time correct. But so how many miles were on this oil when you sampled it?
When I sampled it was 541, just what it says on under the lube is when I
That's how
sampled it.
many miles that's how many miles are on the oil or on the engine?
No, on the engine. That's the what I get from my mileage.
Yeah, so that number should go in the unit time block when you fill out the form. And then in lube time block, you would put how long it's been since an oil change. So how many miles have you put on the truck since you last changed the oil? Do you remember?
Since I last changed the oil is 25, 35, 45, about 22,000 miles.
Okay, then iron at 20 is perfect. You don't need to worry about that
Okay.
at all. But that's why it gets flagged at totally different numbers. And I know that's really confusing, but it's a formula
So I've
based on
been.
how many miles are on the engine and how many miles are on the oil.
I've been kind of confused, I guess, on how to fill out that little paper you send in with the analysis, and I guess
Yeah,
that's where I need to kind of correct.
right. And it's not a big deal because this is still an accurate oil sample. I mean, when I look at it, now that I know there's 540,000 miles on the engine and about 22,000 on the oil, then I can look at this and tell you what's going on. So the good news is, it looks like a while back you had horrible fuel dilution problems. It looks like that's fixed. That's just gone
Yeah,
completely.
I changed the oil at immediately after I saw that. As you can see, I took that oil sample at 523,000, and as soon as I got the results from OPS, I changed it out, and that was at 525.
Yeah.
And because I was worried about that, I checked it at 5,000 miles later, so that was at 530, and
Right.
Then that's when I got the other sample, and it looked good also. So
Yep. So,
what about the oxidation? Should anything to concern about?
No, it's not. I would just keep an eye on that. 21 is no big deal. Some engines just tend to oxidize the oil more. But it, if we don't see any other problems, like the oxidation isn't causing the base to drop, it's not hurting the viscosity. So this is a good-looking sample. I wouldn't be changing anything right now. And then the next time, when you're filling out your paperwork, if you just want a little help, call us up. We'll make sure you get it in the right line. And again, it's not a big deal, but it will help with some of the readings on there. All right. So I'm looking at the clock. We're going to take this into a break, and we're going to come back and get to more of your calls and questions right after this. So don't go away. Check out the website. It's letstruck.com. We're going to have a lot of new stuff coming up soon there. We're going to be expanding our store. We want to be able to get more of the products and services you're looking for in one place, make it nice and easy for you. We're working on trying to get the best pricing we can possibly get on some things. We should be rolling that out pretty soon. CMC will be rolled out here soon as well. And if you want to join us on our recordings, if you want to catch the show earlier in the day during the week, you can join us on our recorded shows. It's real easy to do. Take out your phone and text the word LISTEN to 99,000. So nice and simple. Just text the word LISTEN. Nothing else. Don't worry about capitalization or anything. Text it to 99,000. Wait about 30 seconds. You should get a verification back. And then every time we're recording, we'll send you a text message. And you can join us. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're off to Colorado this time. Rod, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. What can I help you with today?
Rolling resistance on where to find the most accurate numbers. I was looking at the Michelin site and the comparison where you can compare up to four tires against a base tire.
Correct.
And I'm actually wondering how do you actually read that when it's telling you it's so many points below 100?
Yeah, so I helped them design their new site a couple years ago, and it does create some confusion only because I think people were used to the old system. This system is better. It's just a little more confusing. So the way it used to work is that they took a specific tire. It was actually their XZA1. And that tire doesn't even exist anymore. And they said, okay, we're going to call this tire 100. And then we're going to measure every other tire against this one tire. So if this tire is 100, then another tire might show up as 107. And you know it's 7 points higher than the baseline tire. Then what they decided to do was make the calculator compare any tire to any other tire And the way they do it is whatever tire you set as the baseline or as your tire, then they'll say that tire is 100. So let's say that we were looking at a Bridgestone 726, and that tire used to be something like 140-something. Well, now if you put that Bridgestone in as the baseline tire, it's going to call that 100. But then it might call a tire you compare to it 70, because it might be 30 points or, you know, 30 points lower. So it is a little confusing in that you can, if you look up the same tire but compare it to a different tire, it's always going to keep showing up with a different number. So the best way to use the calculator now is to put your tire in as the baseline and then a tire that you're considering, or three or four tires that you're considering, put those in the other spot, and then it will tell you how much better your tire or the tire you're comparing is to the one you already have, or maybe it's going to be worse than the one you already have. That way, it really does make it easier once you understand it. Let's say I have that Bridgestone 726 on my truck, and I want to look at an XZA3, and it shows me that the XZA3 is 30 points lower. Well, then I know for every 10 points I can save, I pick up about a tenth of a mile per gallon. So right away, I look at it and go, oh, if I change to this tire, I can save 3/10 of a mile per gallon. So it is a better, quicker calculator, easier to understand. But the confusion comes in when you check a tire two different ways and you keep getting different numbers on the same tire. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I was also looking at the America Moves by Truck website, and
right.
They have pure numbers based
correct.
On the tire.
And yeah, now, so you can use either one. Those are accurate because all of that information still gets pulled off of Michelin's site. So I know the guy who runs that website, and he pulls his numbers from Michelin. His calculator still shows it the old way, which now is kind of nice because if you like the old way, you can go to his site. If you like the new way, you can go to Michelin. But the numbers underlying those calculations are all the same. They all come from Michelin's testing.
Okay. And then when you're talking about dropping 10 points, for every 10 points, you can roughly a tenth of a mile per gallon. Is that across the board on an 18 tire?
No, that's actually only replacing the drive tires. If we were to replace trailer tires, if you have your own trailer and you replace trailer tires, it's actually a little more than that. Not a lot, but a little more. The trailer affects rolling resistance more than the drive tires. If you're only replacing steer tires, it's actually only about a quarter of that. So steer tires, we don't really get too crazy about rolling resistance. Most steer tires are pretty low anyway, and changing the steer tire rolling resistance doesn't have much of an effect on fuel economy. Drives, every 10 points is about a tenth of a mile per gallon. Trailer, it's a little bit more than that. And steer tires, it's only about a quarter of that. So honestly, on steer tires, you'd have to lower your steer tire points by 30 to 40 points just to pick up a tenth of a mile per gallon. And that almost never happens. So we just don't worry too much about rolling resistance on a steer tire. I pay more attention to durability, wear, that kind of stuff.
So if you could lower trailer tires by 30 points, you could save maybe upwards of 4/10.
Yeah, the difference is biggest on trailer tires and then drive tires and then steer tires we hardly even bother with.
Well, that answers my question. I sure appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to New Jersey. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. See, I had a little turbo problem, and so I went and bought a nice, shiny, brand-new, oversized turbo from Pittsburgh Power, along with their manifold. I can't wait to get home and install it. But my question is to do with the wrap, the turbo wrap. What is the purpose of that turbo wrap, and what are the benefits of it when it's wrapped up? Or are there
any? So, yeah, there are actually. So the idea behind the entire exhaust system, everything from the manifold, the turbo, the exhaust piping, the way we bend it, how long we make it, all of those things have an effect on how easily the air flows out of the engine. And our goal is to get the air to move out as easy as possible. Imagine this. Air has pressure, right? I mean, we know that. Air, we can compress it. We can, when we try to drive through it, we know aerodynamics are important. So imagine if you had this force that was trying to stop the piston from coming up in the cylinder. If there's pressure there that makes it hard for that to happen, the engine has to work harder. And moving the air out of the engine creates back pressure. And we've heard that term, yeah, there's back pressure on the engine. Well, the more back pressure there is, the harder the engine has to work just to move the air out. And if it's got to work hard to move the air out, one, it's burning more fuel to do it, and two, it's robbing that power from the drivetrain. So the whole goal behind designing an exhaust system is to get the air to move as easily as possible. So we port and polish the manifold so the air flows through it better. We create a bigger turbo housing so it flows through the turbo easier. Then we want a nice short, straight exhaust system with bigger exhaust pipe because, again, that helps it flow. Where the blanket and the exhaust wrap comes in is the hotter you can keep that air, the easier it flows. When we get air cooler, it gets more dense, and it's harder to push it out of the exhaust. So we'd like to keep that exhaust as hot as we can keep it all the way out the pipe. So the turbo blanket helps hold the heat in the turbo. And then we can even do exhaust wrap so that the longer we wrap that exhaust, the longer the exhaust gas will stay hot and the easier it moves out. Now, these are all little tiny tweaks. You know, you're not going to take a truck and just wrap or put a turbo blanket on it, probably see a measurable difference. But when we do all of these, that helps. You know, I even saw a device, and I just never got around to testing it, and I'm not sure it would create enough difference. And I'm going to talk about it when I come back. But it's along the same lines. It's along the idea of anything we can do to help move that air out of the exhaust lets the engine be more efficient. Fuel economy, performance, everything. So, and there's even a formula for this. We can measure that airflow, and then we can calculate how much fuel we're going to save. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking about exhaust systems, turbo wraps, turbo blankets, and the whole idea of improving the exhaust flow. And the whole idea, the easier we can get the exhaust out of the engine, the less the engine has to work to push it out, the more performance we can get out of the engine, the more fuel economy we can get out of the engine. But again, these are all small tweaks. But the more of these things we do, the better the fuel economy becomes. And Dave, right before I went to the break, I said I was going to explain something, and then I think a squirrel must have ran by, and now I can't remember what I was going to explain. What was it?
You're talking about something that you were going to test.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
A product that come out. All right.
Sometimes I get so wrapped up in what I'm talking about, I forget where I'm going next. So I was at a truck stop one day where I think it was a truck parts dealer. And I saw this, a tip that you slide over the exhaust stack. You know, like we have turnouts or we have the straight exhaust with the little flapper. This one was a little odd because it was a turnout. So it turned to the back, but then they cut the pipe in half, only where it was turned out at the very top. So instead of being a 360-degree circle, only the front half of the turnout was there. It was 180 degrees, and the back of it was kind of cut off. I'm not sure if I'm describing that so you understand what I'm saying. And I'm looking at it, and I thought, what is the purpose behind that? And the more I stood there and looked at it, the more I realized, you know how at the back of the cab and the back of the trailer, we use aerodynamic devices like air tabs or the smart truck side flaps. And what we're trying to do is to get that air to move around the corner and fill in that gap. Because if you don't fill in that gap is creating a vacuum. And that vacuum is trying to pull the truck backwards. So we put devices on there to make that air turn the corner and fill in that gap. Well, as I'm looking at this exhaust turnout, I'm thinking they made that cut so that there's a straight edge there. And it does create a vacuum. And it creates a vacuum right at the top of the exhaust. And guess what that does? It helps suck the exhaust out of the pipe.
Yeah. Okay.
So somebody was really thinking. I mean, it actually works. I know it works. I don't know if we can measure it. But if you create a vacuum right there at the top of that exhaust, it will work to pull the exhaust out, and the more you pull the exhaust out, the less back pressure there is on the engine. So, you know, if we were to design, you know, just the very best exhaust system we could, we certainly improve fuel economy and improve performance.
Yeah, great. Great. Yeah, I got, I got a single stack and it's 387 Pete, and there's like six or seven bends in it to get to the back. That's my next project, is to get up to Pittsburgh Power and have them design me a straight, short, little shorty weed burner. I'm going to have them do it out there, right there at Pittsburgh Power. So
that's the way to go. Now, the weed burner, obviously, we can't take advantage of this little turnout. But again, I those are minor. We know that shortest, straightest exhaust we can design is a weed burner, and that's going to be more of an advantage.
Yeah, great. Oh, I can't wait to get all that together. Thanks for your info, Kevin. It really, really explained it well. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. You know, that's really one of those big racing things where they are really looking for every tiny little advantage they can get. But if you take some of the worst exhaust systems on the market, like Dave was just talking about, lots of bends, lots of turns, small turbos, we have taken a truck and just with the exhaust system alone been able to gain a half a mile per gallon. That's pretty impressive. Now, that doesn't happen on every truck, but if you take the worst and you really design a good exhaust system and use all those little tricks, you can make a pretty big difference. Let's go to Ohio. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin.
Hey there.
Well, I have a question about kombucha, but I have a couple of things on your last caller.
Sure.
The turbo blanket, you're absolutely correct, but the other advantage, when you go to the bigger turbo, you sometimes will have a small amount of turbo lag, and by keeping the temperature up, it helps that on the bottom end, so your acceleration's better.
Oh, good point. You're absolutely correct.
Yeah, it does. And about the turnout you were talking, if you ever catch one, look at these Cascadias going down the road, and they've got that underneath weed burner style exhaust from the factory.
Okay.
The longest part of that turnout, it kind of looks like a beaver tail. They're somewhat doing that right out of the factory now.
Oh, well, you know what? I said it probably wouldn't work on a wheat burner, but I guess it would, as long as it's in the wind stream somewhere. The problem underneath
it
is the wind.
It kind of looks like it.
Yeah, the wind is just so darn dirty under there. But if you, maybe they've done enough testing and they designed their exhaust so that tip is in a good, clean part of the wind stream. And if it is, it will do the same thing. It will create that vacuum right there that kind of sucks the exhaust out. That's interesting. I'm going to have to go find a truck and look at that.
Yeah. So anyway, when it comes to kombucha, as you know, my issues and not a whole lot's changed. I thought, well, Kevin says you need all kinds of probiotics. I thought, well, I'll buy me some kombucha. So I bought one called Synergy. I actually brought it with me today so I can tell you what kind it is. And it says it's organic kombucha, and ginger berry is the flavor. And I found out yesterday I was going to taste it, and so I tipped it over upside down, and it kind of looked like the Bragg raw apple cider vinegar. Kind of looked like I had a mother on the bottom or something.
It does.
So I shook the tar out of it. And then I cracked the lid, and I said, oh, crap, this stuff's carbonated.
Yes, naturally carbonated.
I didn't know that.
What I do is I just turn the bottle upside down and just gently shake it back and forth or swirl it around upside down. And that will get the mother to kind of circulate through it without creating a ton of carbonation. I'm very familiar with Synergy.
Go ahead.
That's a brand that I've tried probably 100 different kombuchas. Seriously, every time I see a new one, I try them. Two things you're looking for in kombucha. One, organic is really good. Most are, though, because most people making kombucha are pretty into health, so they're not going to use a lot of garbage. One, find a flavor that you like. And two, just watch the sugar content. Some kombuchas are really high in sugar, 4 grams. How many servings are in that bottle?
Serving size, 8 ounces, total of 2 servings.
So just that's the one thing you have to watch, because most bottles of kombucha will call it 2 servings. So when you look at 4 grams of sugar and you're going to drink the whole bottle, it's really 8. But other than,
exactly.
And that's not bad at all. 8 grams in a bottle, not bad. There are a couple that are lower than that. There are lots that are higher than that. So kombucha is great to drink. It's got different probiotic strains than almost any other food. It's made from what's called a SCOBY, which is a symbiotic culture of yeast and bacteria, or bacteria and yeast. So it's got things in it that you're not going to get anywhere else. The only thing I'll tell you is just watch your content for the day.
How much of it should I drink? How much is safe? I don't want it to take me the other way, and then I got another kind of problem.
See, that's the cool thing about probiotics. You know, if you take too much magnesium, for example, magnesium can certainly help with digestion, but if you take too much of it, it goes too far. Probiotics don't do that. Probiotics, they just fix your digestion. Now, there's still a lot we don't know about this, but other than in the very beginning, and you're not in the beginning, you've been on this journey for a while now. I think that you probably have pretty good gut bacteria. I don't think you have what we would refer to as dysbiosis. If you've got severe dysbiosis, you have to watch how many good probiotics you take in, because it can create a mass kill-off of the bad bacteria, and then that bad bacteria kind of wreaks a little havoc in your body as it's dying. But once you get past that initial stage, I don't know if there is such a thing as too many probiotics, but we'll come back. We'll talk about that a little bit right after this. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, real quick heads up, we're heading into segment four. Let me see how we're doing on calls and questions. Looks like we're doing pretty good. We are going to do a second hour, and if you have a question, a comment, a topic, and you want to get through, press one on your phone right now, and I'll be able to get to you in that second hour. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. We're going to get back to the phone calls. We're heading into the final segment. I was talking with Herschel. So, Herschel, I don't think, and we don't know all this yet, but I don't think you can overdo the probiotics. What tends to happen is gut bacteria is kind of self-regulating. Like you're probably not going to get an overgrowth of anything as long as you eat a good, clean diet, which you're doing, and you're eating prebiotics. Those that primarily fiber are good prebiotics. Resistant starches are good prebiotic. Pectin is a good prebiotic. So as long as you're kind of populating your gut with good bacteria and prebiotics, the gut seems to be self-regulating. You know, like for a million years, we never even had to think about this. We didn't take probiotics. We didn't, because we didn't have all the things that were damaging our gut bacteria. It just worked. It just did its own thing. So if we get rid of all the things that damage good gut bacteria, like chlorinated water and antibiotics and lots of sugar, and if we get rid of all those things, I think our gut will self-regulate itself. So I don't think there's any real danger of taking too much.
Okay. Well, when you say prebiotics, now I have to ask, where do you get those? And luckily I caught the lid. Otherwise it would look like a NASCAR victory lane. But, yeah. So how much of it doesn't really matter then? Just drink like a half at one time and start with that and see what happens or what?
You know, I you could drink a bottle, you'll be just fine. I mean, there are some days I drink three bottles. I drink a really, really low sugar version, like 2 grams of sugar per bottle. And I'll drink sometimes three bottles a day. So I just don't think you can have too much. And I've never really noticed any kind of negative side effects from it.
Okay, cool. Cool. Where do you get prebiotics from? What is that? A certain kind of food or what?
Yeah, it's in different kinds of foods. So prebiotics are, they're basically starches or fiber that our body can't digest. So we always thought they were just kind of neutral. You know, they're there, but our body can't digest them. So what's the point? But it turns out that our gut bacteria, good gut bacteria, can digest this starch. So our gut bacteria digests it. It feeds them so that they stay healthy and grow. But when they digest it, they metabolize it into things we can use. They can actually metabolize some of this fiber into vitamins and compounds that our body needs, and we aren't able to convert it ourselves. So it does two things. It feeds the good gut bacteria so they hang around and grow, and the gut bacteria turns it into things we need. So it's present in foods. Leeks are high in a prebiotic compound. Onions have some. Asparagus has a lot. Pectin, which is in apples and apple cider vinegar, and we use pectin to make jellies and things like that. Pectin has a lot of prebiotic in it. Inulin, which is actually a sweetener. There's a whole group of compounds called oligosaccharides that are actually sweet, but we can't digest them. Our good gut bacteria can. What you're starting to see now is companies that make probiotics are starting to add prebiotics to the mix so that you do have both. But again, you can get it in food, psyllium husk, anything with fiber. Fiber tends to be good for gut bacteria like a prebiotic is. Resistant starches. So you can buy potato starch from Bob's Red Mill, and it's dirt cheap. You can get a big bag of it for next to nothing. And if you take a little bit of potato starch and just dissolve it in cold water and drink it, that's an excellent prebiotic.
Interesting. Okay.
So prebiotics are food for our good gut bacteria. Here's another interesting thing. Mother's milk, breastfeeding with mother's milk. It's loaded with probiotics, but it's almost over the top with prebiotics. So when babies breastfeed, not only are they getting the good gut bacteria, but they're getting a big load of food for that gut bacteria as well. The baby can't digest some of the stuff that's in the mother's milk. It's only there to feed the gut bacteria. Let's go to Ohio. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, how are we doing today, Kevin?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. Hey, I'm looking at purchasing one of those Bose AirRide seats here in the next few months. And I just
okay.
want to check with you to see if you have a relationship with them or if you've talked with them about possibly getting a certain number, say 50 to 100 of your drivers that work with you on a consistent basis, putting a down payment down and possibly getting a larger bulk price. And so I was just thinking about that and didn't know if there's anything in the works in the future of that and just reserving, you know, holding off before I purchase one, or just go ahead and make that purchase and get that taken care of.
Yeah, don't hold off. We're not working any kind of bulk discount. And the reason we're not is just we know that that's not a huge seller. It's a big decision. I think there's no way I would ever own a truck without one. And we have, mm-hmm. we do have a very strong relationship with Bose. We've been working with them on the seat from prior to when they even released it. If you call them, you can certainly mention our name. Sometimes they're running some specials that they'll extend if you're one of our listeners. But go ahead and call them, order it. You can mention our name. Maybe they'll give you a deal. But we're not going to work on any kind of a bulk discount just because I just don't see that I could sell 50 of those in the next 5 years sometimes.
Okay. Gosh, that makes sense then.
Yeah, but
I greatly appreciate it.
You're welcome. And you are absolutely going to love that. Like I say, I would not own a truck without one. But we do realize it's a pretty big ticket item, and a lot of people don't understand the benefits. So it's not something that we're going to carry as a distributor, but we do have a very strong relationship with Bose. So check that out. I'm Trying to decide if I should squeeze. Yeah, let's go ahead. I think I can answer this one pretty easy. Jay in Idaho, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
My truck died on me at the Oregon-Idaho border back on September 1st. I had to have it towed to the Volvo dealer in Boise. He quoted me ridiculous repair costs, so I decided, what the heck, it's 11 years old, 1.3 million miles. I bought a new one, okay? Now, I live in Georgia, and I got to get it home. According to the state of Georgia, I cannot pull a load trailer until I get the IRP card from Georgia. Is that correct? And I have to deadhead from Boise all the way to Georgia to get that done.
It's actually easier just to deadhead a truck back to your home state till you get everything set up. If you have time and you can jump through all the hoops, you could probably get it all done and then pull a load. But you can't pull a load until all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted and you have everything in place. And taking a truck home is drop dead easy. You get a temporary tag and insurance and you're done. You just run home. So it's really up to you how many hoops you want to try to jump through in order to be able to pull a load, or if you just rather get it home the easy way and then take care of everything.
That's a 2,000-mile deadhead, though.
That's a long way. So you might want to just jump through the hoops you have to jump through. And you should be able to, although there are some states that require the truck in the physical location because they do a VIN number check before they'll do it. So you're going to have to talk to Georgia and ask them what their procedure is. Every state's different. I don't try to memorize all of these, but you have to start with Georgia and say, do I physically have to have the truck here for any kind of an inspection or VIN number check? And if not, how do I handle all of this paperwork so that I can pull a load out of Idaho? But Georgia, is you're going to have to start there.
I got you. Okay. All right. Well, keep the all that fuel. You got it, right?
There you go. Got it. Got to run. The music's playing. We will. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, we're going to do another hour here. Let me check the call volume real quick. Looks like we're going to have some room for questions. In fact, right now I don't even have enough. We've got a lot of callers, just not a lot of questions. So I'm going to go ahead and start. If we run out of questions, we'll just take the couple of segments we get. But this is your chance. If you want to get through with a question, a comment, a topic, anything, it'll go ahead and press 1 on your phone right now, and we'll get to you. Here we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, getting your authority. The list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, pick up the phone, give me a call, and we'll tackle it here on the air. We're going to get right to phone calls tonight. I've got some things I might talk about in a little bit, but we're going to see what it is that's on your mind today. Let's start off in South Carolina. Jermaine, welcome to the program.
Hey, hello, Kevin.
What's on your mind today? Yep.
Yeah, I got a problem with a Detroit 14-liter.
Okay.
I got a cold thing, injector response time too long, and another one for low voltage. It's the response time for all cylinders. I'm wondering if you know anything about that.
Yes and no. The one thing about codes is that they're not like cut and dried. You can't just look at a code and go, oh, there's that code. This is the problem. The codes just kind of get us started and point us in the right direction. Some codes mean absolutely nothing. Some codes mean something, but they don't really help us much. Some codes will clearly say, this sensor is bad. That's nice when we get one of those. But most of the time, a code is just one piece of information we need in troubleshooting. And one of the problems that I see is too many mechanics rely so heavily on the code that they see a code and they just throw a part at it and then it doesn't fix the problem. But if you go somewhere that's really good at troubleshooting, they'll look at the code. They'll say, okay, that kind of gets me in the right direction. Then they'll go test and verify. They won't just throw parts at it. So I hesitate. Yeah. In fact, I won't try to troubleshoot something just from a code. It gives us a direction to go in, but you really tend to cause more problems if you rely too heavily on those codes. So I would just get this to somebody that knows how to troubleshoot. They're going to use the code, but they're going to go figure it out the right way.
Okay. All righty. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's head off to Indiana. Karen, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I know a lot of guys wouldn't call in and talk to you about this, so I'm the brave one. I'll do it.
Okay.
My husband experienced heat stroke, okay? And ever since we got him rehydrated and back mended, okay, he's been having a lot of urinary problems. Had that, made sure that it wasn't an infection or a prostate issue, okay? And it wasn't. And, of course, there came out a long list of, let's use this medication here, let's use that medication. Not an option, okay?
Right.
I'd rather do it the natural way.
Right.
Okay.
So, this is going to require some more hands-on kind of approach. This, you know, there are certain things that are easy for me on the phone. It's just like trucks. There's some things you call, questions easy, this is what's happening, do this. With the body, it gets a little more complicated. There are some easy things, but this one's going to require a little more analysis, maybe even a... We might be able to do it without a hands-on. One of the programs we're working on right now, so NTPs can work two different ways. In fact, there's an NTP, which is a nutritional therapy practitioner, which is what I am. Then there's an NTC, which is a nutritional therapy consultant. The difference in what they learn is the consultant learns all the same stuff, except they don't learn how to do the physical hands-on evaluation. So they work with people remotely. You don't need to physically go see an NTC because they can do it over the phone, the internet, that kind of thing. We're putting together a program to do remote consultations. So we would do everything except the physical hands-on evaluation. And we're also putting together a program so that, let's say, we did take on his case, we did a consultation, and we solved the problem, great. If for some reason we got to a point and I said, boy, we really need to test this in person, we're working on a program where we're going to partner with NTPs all over the country so that I could say, I really need to get this tested, and here's an NTC along your route, or an NTP. You can stop in. They'll do the physical hands-on. I'd have access to the information. We solve the problem. So that's part of a big project we're working on right now, to be able to do these kind of consultations with people. And then if we need a hands-on, we could get that part done as well. But this is one of those cases. I am absolutely positive we can solve this with nutrition. You do not need drugs. This may be a kidney issue, but it can be solved. It's just not one I can answer on the phone. We need to get some other information.
Okay. Am I hurting him by treating him with like pumpkin seed extract supplement?
This is a
guy that never went to the bathroom in the middle of the night, and now he's doing two or three times in the night.
Now, has anything else changed? Like, has he recently gone more keto or anything like that?
No. I got him totally off the sugar. He has not had a pop since the heat stroke.
Okay, so here's what could be going on. And this may be really simple then, because that is kind of moving closer to keto. When you get rid of sugar, here's the thing. When your body stores sugar or stores carbohydrates, it stores them as glycogen. And it can store about 2,000 calories worth at a time, and then you keep replenishing it, which in our society isn't hard because we eat sugar and carbs all the time. But every time it stores that glycogen, for every molecule of glycogen it stores, it has to store three or four molecules of water. And when it stops storing the glycogen, it gets rid of all that water. So one of the things people notice when they first go low carb or high fat is that they're peeing a lot. And this is why. Because your body's saying, hey, wait a minute. If we don't have all that sugar hanging around, we don't need all this water either. And that may be all that's going on with him right now.
Okay, but this has been going on now for three, four weeks.
Well, what if he's borderline keto, if he's borderline fat adapted, what happens is you keep moving in and out. So if you have a day where you eat a little higher carb, then your body will store that glycogen again. And then the next day, if you go more low carb, then your body says, oh, hey, wait a minute, the glycogen's disappearing. We can get rid of the water too. Then you have a couple days where you eat more carbs and your body stores the glycogen again. So somebody who hangs out in that kind of middle where they're not fully keto adapted and they're going back and forth could experience this. I'm not saying that's what it is. Okay. But it could be a very logical explanation for what's going on.
Because I did test last night. I did test his blood sugar. Because I know that that's the frequent urination is something that goes along with being pre-diabetic. So I did do his blood sugar last night, and it was 135.
Well, what had he eaten in the 3 hours prior to that test?
Nothing.
Okay. So what you want to do, blood sugar, I love testing blood sugar. I think everybody should do it. But it's not a one-time event. You should be testing blood sugar first thing in the morning to see fasting blood sugar. Now, I'll tell you, if he honestly had not eaten or drank anything for 3 hours or more, and his blood sugar was 135, that's elevated.
Right. Because 90 to 110 is normal, right?
I wouldn't worry. Anytime we're under 140, we're not really doing any damage. But if we're 135 and we haven't eaten in several hours, that's an indication that we're starting to become insulin resistant. Because, if I'm 135 an hour after I eat, that's not a big deal. I mean, if you eat any sugar at all, your blood sugar is going to go up if you eat any carbs. But then the body releases insulin. The insulin moves the sugar into the cells, and your number should come right back down within an hour or two. That's why I say if 3 hours later he is showing some signs of elevated blood sugar, I would keep monitoring that, and I would push him more and more towards the keto, because that is what's going to fix this. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We're off to Oklahoma. Jason, welcome to the program.
Well, hello, Kevin. Good to talk to you again.
Great to have you here. What's on your mind? There. All right.
Got an oil sample that should be sent over there, and I thought we'd take a look at it. The last one I took was at the CMC, and this is right at the right time to pull the next one, about a little over 27,000 miles right in there.
Perfect. All right. So everything looks really good. A couple things. This is a 99 International. You have a Series 60, don't you?
No, this is an N14 Cummins.
N14. Okay. Soot is a little high. Nothing that they would flag, but the N14 is a really, really clean burning engine, kind of like the Series 60 when it's pre-emission. They're clean burning. So it's not unusual to be able to get an N14 down to the point where the soot shows up as less than 0.1, which means there's virtually no soot in the oil. You're at 1.5. That's an indication that something is a little out. Nothing major, but, you know, we look at airflow in and out. So if we have any exhaust restriction, a dirty air cleaner, that kind of thing, a leaking charger, cooler, too much exhaust or intake. Go ahead.
Probably overdue to get that fleet air filter cleaned. I need to get that done. And
That's what I would do. I would clean that, check the next sample. If it comes down, great. If it doesn't come down as low as we'd like, then if nothing else is obvious, we usually look at the overhead. If the valve set gets out, then we'll start to see a little more soot. So nothing that I want you to, you know, get all crazy about, but I would just keep an eye on that, because it's an indication that the engine isn't running as efficiently as it could. So it's just something we'll keep an eye on. Now, last time, your last oil sample, the viscosity was 19.2. Do we know why? Was there a lot of Lucas in there?
No, I don't use any Lucas at all. A lot of these oil samples have been showing a little elevated in viscosity, and we've never been able to identify why that is. And
interesting.
So I'm not the good sure news is that.
The good news is this last one was the lowest in, you know, the last four samples, but it's still elevated. A Rotella 1540 should be somewhere in the mid-14s, 14.5. You're at 16.4. But that's a huge improvement from 19.2. The mystery is why. You know what? This would almost be an engine that I would like to do an oil flush on.
Okay.
The only reason I could think that we have this constantly elevated viscosity is we've got sludge in the engine somewhere. It's not getting flushed out with an oil change itself, and that keeps adding to the viscosity even when you change the oil. I wouldn't go out of my way for this, but if you you know, there are a couple places around the country you can get it done, Pittsburgh Power and a couple others. I might look into it and say, you know what, if I'm ever near one of those places, I'm going to run over and get it done.
Is T&E have that system that Pittsburgh Power uses?
That's a good question. I don't know if they do or not. I know they've talked to those guys, but I don't know if they have a machine in there or not. You could certainly call them and ask. And if they don't, maybe we get one in. Yeah.
I need to get up there and talk to Chad anyway again. I'll let him take a look at my alignment again, all that. I had a bracket on my right front steer axle that had to be replaced. And if that... The spring hanger bracket, if that has to be replaced, does that change your alignment or should that not matter a whole lot?
It shouldn't. Well, it can. I shouldn't say that. It could affect the alignment. So anytime you get those kind of parts replaced, and you could always call Chad and tell him the specific part in the specific truck, and he'll say, no, on that truck you bolted on, it can't move anywhere, so it can't change anything. Or he might say, yes, on that truck, if you change that part, we need to recheck the alignment.
Okay. Well, I might give him a call then also. Now, I changed tire size on the steer tires. I went from a low pro to a taller tire. Is that going to affect me a whole lot for rolling resistance or... You know,
not on the steer tire. Wouldn't be measurable. No, it doesn't really have much of an effect on anything. I've changed tire sizes all over the place, even mixed and matched, and it doesn't have much of an effect. And rolling resistance, if that were drive tires, even with the same tire in a different size, it could affect it. And it could even affect it enough to notice it, but not on the steer tire. So I wouldn't worry about it there. Let's go to Tennessee. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I listened to your last show, and there was a gentleman saying about kombucha and taking too many probiotics, and I actually experienced that. I had a friend of mine that made the Kavash, and he made a couple different batches, and he was having me taste it, and I drank a couple ounces of the Kavash. And then I went and he said, well, try this one. And I drank about 4 ounces of that one. And I really liked that one. So I was sitting there sipping on it and stuff. And he goes, you might want to hold back on that because, you know, I don't know the effects of drinking too much.
Right.
Yeah. There's a very,
okay.
Very, very big effect to that. Drinking too much of the Kavash anyways.
Yeah, it's possible to get too many probiotics, but it seems to be only in the beginning. And the theory kind of makes sense that if you haven't been eating clean, if you haven't been eating a lot of good, you know, bacteria in your diet, or you're not getting a lot of prebiotics, we tend to get an overabundance of bad bacteria. That's what causes all the problems. So if we overwhelm the system in the beginning and we kill off the bad bacteria too fast, it's almost like toxic shock to the body. The bad bacteria can kind of, it tries to find its way out. Here's another thing we haven't talked about in a while. You hear a lot about detox, you know, detox diets and detox cleanses, and those can all be good things, but I would warn people away from them. Because the people that are promoting these detox diets or cleanses, they're not paying attention to the fact that the body has 7 pathways to move toxins out of the body. And if you need a detox, the reason you need a detox is because those pathways aren't being used. They're probably blocked. And you have a lot of toxins in your body. The problem is if you go in and kill all the toxins, which is what a detox does, but you haven't cleared those 7 pathways, toxins die off, but they have nowhere to go. And all they do is start moving around the body, wreaking havoc. Kind of the same thing can happen if you overload the probiotics in the beginning. It's almost like a detox. But we need to clear those detox pathways first. And that takes time. That's the good, clean diet, getting rid of, you know, the junk processed food. And over time, your detox pathways will clear. And then if you go overboard on the probiotics, it doesn't seem to matter. But in the beginning, I think you experienced that.
Right, yeah, definitely experienced something there. Now, the last question I had was, I have a buddy of mine. I've got brand new dual X-Line Energy D tires, drive tires, and he's got singles, wide singles he wants to get rid of that has 70,000 miles on them. I was kind of, you know, thinking about it because of the difference in the money savings on the fuel economy, but 70,000 miles on a different truck, I didn't want to take a chance of putting them on here and then the wear is kind of funny and go, we'll have to spend $4,000 on tires.
I wouldn't worry about that on a drive tire. I've never seen a drive tire. Irregular wear on a drive tire is pretty rare. You know, we know a loose wheel bearing could cause irregular wear. Alignment, though, even if you get the two drive tires way out of alignment, the wear tends to happen on the steer tires, even if it's the drive tires that are out of whack. So I wouldn't worry about you. Now, steer tires, yeah, that might be an issue. If I pulled steer tires off one truck, put them on another, there may already be a pattern set up that just gets worse on my truck, but I wouldn't worry about that on drive tires.
Okay. Yeah. That's why I was wondering. I just, you know, for the amount of the money or the tires, I didn't want to, you know, run down. That's like 3/4 of a year wear on those other ones. So
I wouldn't worry about it. In fact, you know, I've in the past, and I still recommend it. If I don't run wide singles, then what I will do is run all position tires everywhere. And one of the ways to get them to wear better on your steer axle is to put them on the drive axle first. The drive axle tends to scrub them down nice and even. Then when you move them to the steer, they wear better. So I would not worry about pulling a steer tire off of a different truck and putting it on here. You'll be fine. There's the music. I've got to get to a break. We'll be right back with more your calls and questions right after this. Kevin Rothenberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to some phone calls. We're going to head off to Kansas. Chad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I heard in the last show, guys talking about this, the bow seat, and they go for what, like $6,000?
That was the original price. I think some of the specials now are down to about $4,500.
Okay. If you know, you told he was asking about discounts. If you're one of the owner ops that cannot afford that, that's just not in your budget, a good second choice seat to that are the Sears Atlas seats, because Bose uses the Sears Atlas bottom. And the only reason I say that is because the Sears are actually hand fabricated welded metal, to where the typical national seats are essentially stamped and bolted together metal.
But let me explain something so people are not confused. The seat itself, the physical part that you sit on, yeah, that is the same thing. The concept behind the Bose, though, has nothing to do with the part you sit on, how comfortable or how well that might be made. Those are all good things. But there is not another seat anywhere on the planet that does what the Bose Ride does. All seats are air ride. The Bose is not air ride. It is controlled by computers and electromagnetic actuators. So the whole point of the Bose is that it isolates your body from the vibration of the truck. And that's where the health benefits come in. So this isn't a seat that's all about being comfortable when you sit in it. It's about the movement of the seat itself. The movement of the Bose Ride system is computer controlled electromagnetic actuators. It responds in milliseconds. And the whole point of it is to cancel out the vibrations that are so harmful to the body. So there are other good seats, and the brand you mentioned is an excellent seat. It is the same seat, but it's the movement mechanism of the seat that makes the Bose, it's really in a class all by itself. There isn't anything else on the market like it. So I appreciate the heads up, but I don't want people to get confused and think that another premium seat even comes close. Because it just doesn't. There's nothing else that works anything like the Bose Ride system when it comes to the isolation from the vibrations. Let's go to New Mexico. Pete, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Kev?
Hey, good. What can I help you with today?
I bought some drive tires and wheels and stuff like that, through that Michelin program. And at the time, I didn't have that, how you have to have that exempt tax form filled out. Anyways, after I got the tires and stuff, and even before they did the billing, I sent them that, charged me for the tax, and I haven't been able to get that tax money back. And the guy that I talk to there all the time is Tom, and he says, well, that's accounts payable. I don't have nothing to do with that. I was just wondering, God, do you have an avenue that I could pursue? Because his is the only number that I have.
Yeah, I really don't. Michelin's just a big company. We deal with a whole different side of the company. With our program, I tend to talk to the engineers a lot. I tend to talk to marketing because, they're the ones that we kind of partner with. And we don't really deal much with the operations side. So maybe I missed it in there. Do you now have the tax number?
Oh, yeah. They have it on file and everything. And first of all, Tom said what it called. Well, you'll be good for next time. What do you mean? What do you thought? I had that exemption coming all along. It's just that the form wasn't made out. And he says, well, in the hands of accounts payable. What I can't understand is supposedly that money would go to the state of Wisconsin. That's what I'm from.
Correct.
So, we're talking about refunding money. And like I said, they had that before actually. Got the billing, from them, and, trying to pursue it, just like,
trust
everybody's just they're just trying to blow it off onto somebody else. And, it sort of ticks you off a little bit, to me. I'm at the point where I need steer tires. I might go to a different brand just because of that.
Look, I get it. And I know it's frustrating. And sometimes the bigger the company is, the more frustrating it is to work with them. Because like you said, if you get the wrong person, it's easy for them to just blow you off and pass you on. And I don't know what the rules are on this, the regulations, if they've already collected the money and paid it out to Wisconsin. But it seems to me like there should be a way to refund this. You have the number. You don't owe the tax. And unfortunately, I don't have any contacts at Michelin that are going to be able to help in this. They're all in, like I say, we deal with different parts of the company. And all you can really do, as frustrating as it is keep calling and kind of, get a little pushy if you have to. Or ultimately, if you're not satisfied, then the way we vote is with our dollars. And I'd hate to see you go buy a different tire, but I understand how frustrating that is sometimes.
Well, exactly. And, that's where I'm at. I think what I'm going to do is give them one more chance before I purchase my steer tires. And, I can tell you the truth, I've been buying them for my cars, my pickup and all of that. And I just can't understand it. We're talking about something that is going to go to the state of Wisconsin. It's not like they got to keep it. So I don't see what the issue is, but it is what it is. So.
Yeah. Anyways. Yeah. I wish I could help you. We just really don't deal with anybody on that side of the company. And I agree. It's frustrating and it's unfortunate. They are a great company. They have great customer service and obviously great products. But once in a while, somebody falls through the cracks and, you know, you've got to decide what you want to do. Let's go to Indiana. Charles, welcome to the program.
Hey, is that me?
It is. What's on your mind today?
I want to know, okay, so like I go into the grocery store to buy a vegetable. Which ones are good for me and which ones aren't? Because I know like I don't want to get potatoes. Potatoes are high in starches and stuff. But which ones are falling in that fat category?
Almost vegetables are almost completely devoid of fat. So the only, the only vegetable that really has a lot of fat is an avocado, but it's not a vegetable, it's a fruit. So we're not looking for fat in our vegetables. We can add a lot of fat to them. We can eat them with butter. We can eat them with coconut oil. We could eat them with mayonnaise, you know, or high fat condiments. What we're looking for in the vegetable is we want it to be low carb. We don't so much care if it's got fat or not because most of them just don't. So here's, I can break the vegetables down into three groups that will help you identify the lowest carb. If it grows below ground, it's going to be a high carb vegetable and you want to limit it. You don't have to eliminate them completely. You can eat them. You just want to watch that you don't eat too many of them. So things like carrots, potatoes, obviously, sweet potato, onions, leeks, anything that we're eating the root of the vegetable, the roots are all high in starch, rutabagas, okay. All of those things. So those are good. You do want to add them to your diet because, like I was talking earlier, those starchy root vegetables are the ones that tend to have the fiber that feeds our good gut bacteria. So I will eat a lot of leeks. I have almost stopped eating onions and I almost use leeks all the time instead because leeks are loaded with a good prebiotic. Now, so underground vegetables are high in carbohydrates. You want to limit the use of those, but not get rid of them completely. Vegetables that grow above ground are lower in carbohydrates. So broccoli, cauliflower, peppers, squashes, those kind of things, if they grow above the ground, then they tend to be lower in carb. Then we could go to the third group, which is the lowest in carbohydrates. And I'll tell you what that is right after this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to the phone calls. I was talking with Charles in Indiana about different vegetables. Below the ground, highest carbs. Above the ground, lower carbs. And then the vegetables with the lowest carbs are like leafy greens, things like spinach, kale, Those kind are and darker lettuces. Like, you don't want to really eat iceberg lettuce. It's got almost no nutrition. The darker the leaf, the more color it has, the more nutrients it's going to have, and those are all very low carb. Like, you can eat as much spinach as you want. It's got tons of nutrients, and it's very low in carbs. So if you think about your vegetables that way, under the ground, highest carb, above the ground, vegetables, lower carb, and then green leafy vegetables, the lowest carb.
All right, and then what about stuff that grows in water? Like kiwis and stuff.
You can't beat that stuff. As a matter of fact, I was I am in the process of testing a bunch of sea vegetable snacks because I think these are things that everybody should try adding to their diet. So one of the things we want to get out of vegetables are minerals. And if we stick to organic vegetables, we're going to get a lot more minerals. But if you start looking at sea vegetables, nori, dulse, any of the seaweed kind of stuff, it can have hundreds of times more minerals than land vegetables. And it's got some minerals that we just have a really hard time getting anywhere else. Like iodine is almost impossible to get in our diet. That's why they started putting iodine in salt, and if that's table salt, iodized salt, that's added in because it was so hard to get in our diet. The problem is iodized salt is garbage because it's overly processed, and when you go to sea salt, there's no iodine in it. So we really do need to be adding sea vegetables, and I'm sitting here eating some right now, and they're pretty darn good. So I'm testing because we're going to pick up a line of sea vegetables and put them in our store. But if you can find seaweed snacks, nori, dulse, there's a couple different varieties. Those are excellent. You should be eating a little bit of that every day.
So I'm picturing you right now. They're eating your seaweed and floating around on your boogie board.
There you go. That's right. Yeah, sea vegetables, we're going to be talking a lot more about those. I'm just trying to, and I have a brand right now I really like. We're going to be talking to them about getting that stuff in our store so it's easy for you to find. Let's go to Illinois. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Back in 2010, 2011, I had a ostomy. Took out my large intestine. And I'm just wondering, honestly, what is the purpose of the large intestine? What does it absorb nutrients-wise? And what should I be doing different in my diet?
Wow. I can answer some of these questions, but I may not be able to answer what to do differently without doing some research. But I will, because I love researching new topics. So, let's talk about digestion real quick. Stomach is kind of where we start to break down all the food. Next step, it goes into the small intestine, and the gallbladder and the pancreas work on it to digest fats. The small intestine is where we pull most of the nutrients out of our food. So you're still okay with most of the nutrients. The large intestine, though, this is where most of our gut bacteria live. There is very little gut bacteria in the small intestine. In fact, we don't really want it there. If it moves up into the small intestine, it actually creates some problems. So we want the good gut bacteria is all in our large intestine. And it does so many things, and we're still learning about that, that I don't know what happens when you lose your large intestine. I don't know where your good gut bacteria is supposed to live. So it seems to me your immune system could be deteriorated because of that. The good gut bacteria is responsible for creating a lot of our neurotransmitters, things like dopamine and serotonin. So I'm not sure what happens to that in your body if you lose your large intestine. This is also where the good gut bacteria take certain foods that we eat and they extract nutrients out of them. Like they take short chain fatty acids out of butter and they convert them to butyrate, which feeds our intestinal cells, which is a good thing. The good gut bacteria pull certain vitamins out of food that we can't pull out. So I know what it does. I know why the large intestine is there, and I know what happens there. But I don't know what you do if you lose it. That's a really good question, and I am writing it down right now because I want to go research that.
Yeah, because I had Crohn's disease, and I ended up having to take it out.
Yeah.
Doing the ketogenic diet, and I'm worried about not being able to absorb all the fats that I'd want to be taking.
No.
In, so,
you don't have to worry about that because all of that happens at the very beginning of the small intestine. So as soon as the food leaves your stomach and enters the small intestine, that's the point where the gallbladder releases the bile to digest the fat, and the pancreas releases enzymes to digest the rest of the food. So the digestion is happening really early on in the small intestine. And then as the food now digested travels through the small intestine, we're absorbing about 90%+ of the nutrients in the small intestine. When it gets to the big intestine, that's when the gut bacteria start doing their thing, and they pull out some of those last nutrients we're not able to get, and they create all those neurotransmitters. So you don't have to worry about keto should not have any negative effect on you at all. In fact, it might have a lot of positive effect. I'm going to go do some research on what kind of things happen, like, if this gut bacteria is so important to us, and it is, what happens when you lose the home for all the good gut bacteria? I don't know that, but I'm going to find out.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Look forward to hearing on that. Thank you.
All right. So I have a job to do. I'm going to get busy on that. Let's see. Let's head off to... Oh, actually, we have somebody who might have a answer for our Michelin tax issue. Dave in New York, go ahead.
Hey, Kevin. Listen, I'm from Wisconsin also, and I got to wrestle with them every single time I buy tires through OIDA. And what they need over there is they need the Wisconsin sales tax use exemption certificate, and they need it filled out properly, which isn't much. And depending upon which accountant gets that, I mean, I had mine sent back two or three times already, but keep on them. And you got to send them a copy of that every single time you purchase tires. They don't hold it on file for you.
So it sounds like Wisconsin specifically, this may not even be a Michelin issue. It's the state of Wisconsin that makes this difficult.
Well, I'm not certain because it comes right from, Michelin's accounting department. They got to have that form filled out precisely, and the form is very. I mean, there's nothing to it. You put your company name on it, you sign it, and you got to put down on the first line, "I hereby certify that I'm engaged in the business of selling, leasing, licensing, or renting." You got to put down common or contract carriage, and then the next line, you got to put tires on it. You sign it and send it to them, and I never had to put a single tax number or anything on there, but got to be filled out. They've got to be filled out precisely every time, and every time I buy tires from them, I got to resend it to them. It's a process.
it sounds like he just needs to stay on top of it and keep bugging them.
Yeah, that's it. That's all. I mean, you get the customer service guy, and he'll tell you one thing, and then the accountant tells him something else. And depending upon the accountant you get, you really got to satisfy the accounting department.
There you go. Well, I appreciate that. That clarifies that issue. So I would just keep bugging him. I would get that money back. Even if you decide you're not going to work with Michelin next time because they pissed you off this time, I'd still keep bugging them until I got my money back. And it just, you know, this is what we deal with sometimes. Individual states can sometimes be a little more difficult to work with. There's the music. That means I am all out of time. I've got to wrap this up. We will see you next time. Be safe. Be profitable. Be fit and healthy. Always do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow for the Power Hour and General Questions.